This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us right now at 1-800-462-7413. And as always, Zorba, along with our interesting calls, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, wiffle ball, dodgeball, kickball, stuff you often did as kids and as teenagers. Guess what? It's becoming the league du jour. We'll talk about that and social networking in the physical way, things that are changing in America.
I have some questions about that. That's coming up. What else?
I bet you do. Salt, salt, salt. We've been talking about sugar and high fructose corn syrup. Now we're going to talk about salt, talking about change in the American diet, which the Institute of Medicine is recommending, what it means for you.
It's been in the news. What's our recipe?
Southwest vegetarian cornbread bake. It's one wonderful recipe.
Coming up from Lafayette, Indiana listener Erica Morin, and we'll find out whether there's salt in that recipe. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. To the phones we go, Zorba, and our first caller. A listener with us in New York City. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Fine, except I have a little head cold. What's up?
Well, funny thing, that's what I'm calling about. I get bad colds, and it seems like even though I know they're going to come on to me, I can't figure out a way to stop them. And once I get them, they take me out of service for like several days. It's quite annoying. I get a cold, and sometimes it's almost as bad as getting the flu. I know I don't have the flu because I'll take my temperature, and I don't have any nausea or anything like that. But if I get a cold, I know it's coming. I can feel the sore throat first, and then it starts to build, and then I start sneezing. I get a stuffy nose. I get aches and pains. I feel almost as bad as somebody who has the flu. And I wish I could figure out a way to, first of all, not let it happen. It happens maybe once, twice a year. And also, when I know it's going to come on to me, I've tried in the past taking zinc tablets or taking a lot of vitamin C. Doesn't seem like anything that I can figure out is going to stop me from getting the bad cold. I know there's no cure for the common cold, but I was wondering if you guys had any ideas, you know?
What do you do for a living?
I work in radio, actually.
You work in radio. Oh. Okay, so you're not – do you have any young kids at home at all?
No, I'm single.
Because a lot of people get colds because they come into close contact with young children, you know, and kids are sort of not to disparage children. I have four of them. I love them. Cesspools of disease. That's what a friend of mine once called them because they have all this mucus that's filled with viral particles.
Congratulations on your new cesspool of disease.
But they're repositories of that. And in fact, in this state of Minnesota, when they started immunizing children with a certain immunization that basically cut down on the strep pneumonia virus, they found out that Medicare claims for pneumonia and hospitalization dropped by 15%.
Oh.
In other words, because grandparents were not in close contact with children, rather were in close contact with children who no longer had this particular bacteria, they didn't spread it to the grandparents who then essentially would get sick and go into the hospital. But I mention it because that's step number one. So step number one is where's their intimate contact with children, which obviously is not in your case.
I am in contact, obviously, with microphones and computer keyboards.
Yeah, but
they don't
spread it. It's usually person to person. Now, but you bring up the other important point, which is basically using the hand sanitizer. That can cut down. And you just take a few bottles of Purell, whatever one you like the feel of. I find I'm very sensitive. There's some I like and some I don't like at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you pick a hand sanitizer that you use, and then just throughout the day you kind of put that on. Now, prevention. Does vitamin C work? No, it doesn't work. Linus Pauling was great. He was the only person who got two Nobel Prizes, one for peace for the nuclear disarmament movement and one for physics. But he didn't get a Nobel Prize for vitamin C in the common cold. He thought it worked. Then the scientific research was done because he thought it worked. And the answer was it doesn't work. You know, that's one of the medical myths. It just is, you know, we need vitamin C. It'll prevent a common cold. It doesn't work. Now, what about zinc? Well, zinc was thought to decrease the amount of time, you know, the cold is in your body. There was one scientific study, one good scientific study, and then there were several companies that made billions of dollars on zinc, put zinc in your nose, and lo and behold, people who put zinc in their nose stopped getting the sense of smell. So it didn't stop their cold, but it stopped them from enjoying food at wonderful restaurants. They stopped smelling things. So now there are zinc products. The FDA recommended do not put zinc in your nose. The tablets, they don't really do much, but they don't prevent anything. So the answer is nada. Yeah. Some people just get colds. Now, you as somebody on the air, you know whenever you get a cold because it's like, oh, my gosh, my voice changes.
And I have to tell somebody you're going to need to have somebody fill in for me for 2, 3, 4 days.
Yeah.
Other people that get a cold and they're out for maybe one day, maybe not even.
Absolutely. And when I get a cold, I'm in the office, and often if I'm sniffling, I'll say to people, excuse me, I have a cold. And you know what they say to me? Nothing. Because they're here for their problem, and
right.
They actually, the fact that I have a cold, they don't really care about. They just want to make sure I don't have a stroke.
There's no sympathy for the doctor.
That's
right.
No sympathy, no respect. Well, thank you so much for your call.
Any further advice? I mean, no vitamin C and
doesn't do anything.
You know, zinc doesn't
vitamin
work.
C doesn't do anything. Staying hydrated, of course, is important.
Right.
But Americans are nuts about hydration. Eight glasses is more than enough. If you stay away from people and you become a hermit, you'll stop getting your colds.
That'll be my advice.
Okay, and so when you have a cold, I shouldn't go to the doctor.
No, you shouldn't. You know, you shouldn't.
And the other message I get from that last call is I should get 2 or 3 days off.
That's right, absolutely.
Starting right now.
Yeah, no, when your day is done. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your call.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. We keep on going. A listener now in Olney, Illinois. Hello.
You, Tom and Zorba. Greetings from the home of the white squirrels.
The white squirrels.
Now, do they have white squirrels in Olney?
Absolutely, and it's a big deal here in town. It's a crime to run them over, and there's a scientific count every year. It's the emblem on the patches for the police department, the 4-H groups. We're very proud of our white squirrels.
Do they exist anywhere else?
Rumor has it that there are other colonies,
but we're
keeping ours.
Rumor has it that.
But if they're anywhere else, that's one that was born in Olney
and
scurried over to some other place.
No doubt.
How can we help you?
Well, I'm a 50-something female, not too keen on sweating, and I somehow found myself signed up for a mini triathlon. Luckily, I'm also signed up for a 12-week training program. The program staff are very, very good to us, take wonderful care of us, and bring in speakers to give us helpful hints to prepare for the event.
Mm-hmm.
One speaker, a nutritionist, recommended that we consider drinking sports or energy drinks rather than water on the premise that on the day of the event, we won't be able to drink enough water to replenish our sodium, potassium, electrolytes, and all that good stuff. So my question is whether there's basis in fact for this. Would you recommend the approach of doing the sports and energy drinks rather than water, given that some have sugar, they all have stuff that I don't know how to pronounce, and is all this really better than water?
They all have stuff that you don't know how to pronounce. More people die of overhydration in marathons in America than from dehydration.
Really?
More people die of overhydration. Let me repeat that. They die because they drink too much water during marathons, and they're never the professional marathoners. They're the amateurs.
Well, what happens? How do you die from too much
hydration?
What
happens is you overhydrate, you develop low sodium because you're overhydrating, so you're diluting the sodium and the potassium in your body. You go into a tent. They immediately assume, because you can't test for electrolytes, that you're actually dehydrated when you're actually overhydrated. Sometimes they get an IV that makes it worse, and 5 to 10 people a year die from it. More die of overhydration in America than tetanus shots and snake bites combined.
Wow.
So overhydration is more of a problem than underhydration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is when you're exercising and you're in a marathon, you cannot depend on the normal way you test hydration, which is thirst. Thirst is a great, great thing. Our body develops a sense of thirst when we're thirsty. Or we go to the washroom and we go, gee, my urine is a little concentrated. I've been exercising. I better drink more. So thirst and urine, frankly, are very good ways to judge it. Well, you can't do that when you're in a marathon. So what you want to do, first of all, just hydration, we'll do electrolytes next, is take a reasonable amount of drink and figure that out before and not just keep on drinking. So if you're really sweating a lot, you probably need an extra 8 to 12 ounces every couple of hours. Depends on how fast you're going, how much you're working, and your trainer will give you a concept of how much you're losing. You know, the really, really good exercises, obviously, who are moving very fast, they need more water quicker, but they know how to balance themselves. So your trainer will tell you how much fluid you need. That's one part.
Okay.
Now, do you need the sugar? Well, sugar's pretty good when you're exercising. Sugar's okay. It gives you some instant energy, so you don't have to take sugar from your liver that's stored there and make it into glucose. So I think a little sugar is great when you're exercising. It's absorbed very quickly, so a sugary drink, if you want sugar while you're exercising and doing a marathon, is really better than a diet drink. Diet drink has no nutritional value, and it has, you know, all the artificial junk that you don't need. Now, do you need potassium? Well, the Gatorade people say, how did anyone exercise before potassium? What was life before Gatorade? What did people do 25 years ago before Gatorade was invented? Did they collapse on the field? Did they die of low potassium? No, I don't remember that. Gatorade is not a FDA-approved drink. It's just that they put a little potassium in there. Why? Because they know you lose a little bit more potassium when you're exercising. It's debatable. It's debatable. Now, once again, if you are a marathon athlete and you're going for 8 hours, maybe you need a little more potassium. If you're a football player in the NFL and, you know, you're 300 hulking pounds and you're banging into somebody else, maybe you need a little more potassium. But sports drinks have never been shown to be superior from a point of view of health to just drinking water.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you so
and
much
good
for
luck.
Your help. Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. What's this about their organizing stuff like kickball and dodgeball that we used to play as kids?
Yeah,
now they're
yeah.
organizing it?
Yeah, they're organizing. Kickball, dodgeball, all that fun stuff you did as kids. Kids, you know, a lot of people in their 20s and 30s, 20 and 30-somethings, are playing kickball and dodgeball. They're not in middle school anymore, and they're
adults,
having fun.
Adults are playing dodgeball.
Well, 20s and 30s, I call them adults, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're clapping, they're high-fiving. You know, they're actually engaged in leagues, but these are sort of non-competitive fun leagues. Non-competitive. So
come
what do you think
on.
About that?
Dodgeball.
Dodgeball
leagues.
And kickball.
Why?
Leagues. Fun. Now, you know, the thing about exercise is if you don't make it fun, it's hard to do. Have you ever looked at joggers when they come in from jogging? I used to be a jogger. Some joggers, when they come in, they smile when they're all done. And sometimes they look awful, like, oh, I hate to go out. I got to take my run. Well, some people get their exercise by having fun, engaging in. It doesn't have to be competitive.
Well, it
is
if you're in a league.
Well,
that's the point.
Well, there are leagues with a small L and there are leagues with a capital L, right?
I don't know. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, there's some leagues where people are highly competitive. They go, well, you know, I'm in a golf league and, you know, I've got to really do well, or a bowling league. These are not – do you think dodgeball could be competitive or kickball?
Well, if you're in a league, apparently it is, because the whole point of a league is there's a winning team and a losing team.
Yes, that is the point. Well, but it depends on how much fun they're having. You see, that's it, Tom. You are so competitive. Immediately you're looking at this fun social thing and you're thinking about this as highly competitive.
Well, this
– It's lightly
but competitive. But this stuff they can get in the league, as I understand it, for really cheap as opposed to softball leagues and baseball leagues.
It's cheap. It's inexpensive. And more important, it's better social networking than Twitter.
Yeah. So as opposed to baseball or softball, these are leagues
that
of
are
people
fun.
Who can't do real sports.
Wait a minute.
And
what do you mean?
And who are kind of wusses.
Wait a second. Kickball is a real sport. It's a real fun sport. I mean, come on. You go out there and kick the ball. You have a lot of fun. You feel like a middle schooler. Wusses. It's a wussy league. I don't think so.
1-800-462-7413. Here's a St. Louis, Missouri listener with us now, Zorba. Hi.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
I'm calling because I'm a little bit confused. So I'm trying to determine what my appropriate weight is. And I talk to my doctor, and I look at all the metrics, And, you know, based on BMI range or based on all kinds of things that you hear anecdotally about 2 pounds a decade after you're 18, what your weight was then and all kinds of things. And my ideal weight range is 112 to 149 for a 5 foot 28-year-old woman, a 5 foot five, I'm sorry, 5 foot five, 28-year-old woman, based on all these different things. Well, I'm at 140, which is technically within those ranges, but I've had 4 babies in the last basically 5.5 years, and I'm not where I want to be, but it's hard to determine what's a healthy goal when you're already within the healthy parameters.
Yeah, well, I would say that's pretty good if within 5.5 years you've got 4 kids. And you're still within the parameters.
Yeah, I would say that's very good. So you've had 4 babies in 5 years.
My oldest will be turning 5 in July, and then we have a 3.5-year-old, a little boy turning 2 in June, and our youngest is 4 months.
Oh,
and they're
how
all
cool.
boys.
How cool! I can relate to that. Well, we had 3 babies in 3 years, so I can relate to 4. Well,
you're,
I think it's really smart. You want to get it done with.
Absolutely.
And they're all boys. How lucky
and
you
all
are.
Very,
boys
very
are
lucky.
So easy to raise.
Yeah, it's a lot of lively households.
Yes, that's exactly it. Weight issues. So the data, if we look back at some of the data, there's some data from long-term studies done at Harvard. And these are Harvard graduates, which, of course, everyone in America is just like a Harvard graduate, right? That's what we're all – certainly those who live in Lake Wobegon are like Harvard graduates. But they've looked at them, that they followed them for a number of years, the Baltimore Longitudinal Study. There are 3 or 4 other studies. And people who maintain somewhere near their high school graduation rate, and I think it's about plus or minus 10%, turn out to be just healthier. They live longer, they have less heart disease, they have less stroke, they even have less cancer, and they definitely have less diabetes. Very, very interesting. So they look back from that and they go, what's your ideal body weight? And does it fit with BMI? Now, BMI is another thing that's very interesting. BMI, which we measure, you go into the doctor that defines obesity, doesn't work in men who are highly muscular. Men who are very muscular appear to be obese and have, because the BMI shows that they're obese, when in fact they don't, they just have lots of muscle. So men who are very muscular and have very little body fat, the BMI doesn't work. And it also turns out it doesn't work at the thin end of the spectrum either. In other words, if you look at people who are just thin, and that's 5% of the population who cannot gain weight and want to gain weight, they're not there either. So that's why when you read stuff, it's all over the map. Is it BMI? Is it height? Is it weight? You know, how does it relate to that? I think a reasonable thing to do is look at what you were when you were at your ideal weight. And for many people, that was their high school graduation rate. For some people, they're heavy at that time. And then say, that's about where I should be within about 10 or 20%, and throw out the other numbers.
Okay.
You know, you have to throw it out. So wait, what is your height? What's your height is 5'4"?
I'm 5'5".
5'5". And what is your weight?
My weight's 140.
And then what did you weigh when you graduated high school?
136.
So you're right around where you should be. That's about what it is.
So, yeah, right in there.
You're right in there. That's exactly it. We tend to gain 4 pounds between, in America, 4 pounds between October 1st and January 1st. We gain roughly 4 pounds. That's most people in Wisconsin, we call it our winter weight. And we gain that as if we're going to be bears going into the den. But we gain about 4 pounds. And the problem is between January and June, we tend to lose 2 of those pounds. The net gain is roughly, in America, 2 pounds a year, 20 pounds a decade, 100 pounds for 4 or 5 decades. And if you look at obesity in America, it's these small weight gains that add up over time. Most people do not gain 40 or 50 pounds at a crack. They gain 4 pounds. So that's what you want to look at. When you're 4 pounds overweight, look at what you're eating and cut it back.
I know, after you give birth and you're nursing, you can eat as many Oreo cookies as you want, and then you have to realize, this comes to an end. And I'm coming to that point and thinking, I'm going to have to be giving up all my cookies.
There you go. That's it. You don't need those many calories anymore. So, well,
exactly.
Thanks, so much, and congratulations on those 4 kids. Keep your energy level up so you can take care of them the way you
thank
are.
Thank you, guys.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, before the break, let's ride over to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help out a loyal listener from Appleton, Wisconsin. Now, this question comes from Paul, who's a high school student looking for advice on his senior trip to a theme park. He writes, all the seniors at my high school, including me, are taking a trip to Great America. I've only been on one roller coaster in my lifetime and would love to go on more. It's not the fear of roller coasters I have. It's the fear of throwing up or feeling like I'm going to throw up afterwards. Are there any special precautions I can take to ensure that this doesn't happen often? I'd prefer to be safe rather than sorry.
Well, you're safe when you puke. I mean, the other people weren't safe if you vomit on them.
Yeah, but you'd rather be, you know, you'd rather feel good.
You'd rather feel good. That's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah. Why would you want to go on a roller coaster that makes you nauseous? But on the other hand, people like to do that.
Because you're a kid.
Yeah, you're a kid. Well, there are a couple things. First of all, Dramamine, over-the-counter, traditional medicine. It's an antihistamine taken at least 1 hour before you go on the roller coaster. That's the best thing. That's easy. That's quick. It's inexpensive. Or a scope patch, scopolamine patch. And it's a patch you get from your doctor. You put it behind your ear. It takes about 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours before it gets into the bloodstream. It's very effective. And a lot of people like the patch better than the Dramamine because the patch is associated, is not as much associated with sleepiness. Dramamine can make you a little sleepy. Mm-hmm. But if you're a teenager, you have plenty of energy and you're less likely to be sleepy. So your choice, Dramamine without a prescription or the scope patch with a prescription.
This is pretty much the same stuff you use when you're on a ship.
Yeah, when you're on a ship and you're going back and forth. So when was the last time you were on a roller coaster?
I was going to ask you the same
question. Yeah, well, you know, I don't like roller coasters.
Have you ever been on one?
Yes, I was on roller coasters when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I associate roller coasters with vomiting. And because every time I'd get out, I would vomit. So I do not go on roller coasters.
The last time I was on a roller coaster, I was young.
Yeah.
I was on with my sweetheart.
Yeah.
And she dumped me.
After the roller coaster?
No, it took a couple, 3 weeks.
Oh, so. So I associate it with vomiting, and you associate it with dumping.
We're here to help you with all the ups and downs of your lifestyle question. Just send them to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Lots more coming up. More of your calls, of course. We have some interesting research to talk over, our medical myth buster. Before that, our recipe coming up next here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 1-800-462-7413. We have listeners waiting, but a line is open now for you at 800-462-7413. But it's that time in the program now, before we get to the phones, for our recipe. And this one comes to us from guest chef in Lafayette, Indiana, Erica Morin. Erica, hi.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, a little head cold, but other than that, okay. How are you?
Good. I'm delighted to be here.
We're happy to have you to tell us all about Southwest Vegetarian Cornbread Bake.
Yep.
Well, so how long have you been making this recipe?
Well, actually, I just came up with it a few months ago. I have a friend, Brittany, that's a vegetarian, and she comes over for dinner pretty often, and I realized, although I consider myself a good cook, after she became vegetarian, I realized that I structured my cooking around my protein or the meat of the meal, and that my repertoire of vegetarian meals was somewhat lacking.
Mm-hmm.
So I started trying to plan more vegetarian meals to cook for us.
I think it's a great idea. By the way, I just came back from India a few months ago, and the restaurants in India are veg and non-veg.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting way to state it. It's either it's vegetarian or non-vegetarian. That's not the way we look at restaurants. We look at restaurants as restaurants or vegetarian. You know, it's a totally different attitude.
And I think this is kind of an inventive thing because I know we go to Southwestern restaurants and they have black bean soup with cornbread on the side, and this has beans in it, and it has cornbread.
I think it's great. You like Southwestern. Southwestern cuisine.
Oh, yeah,
I know that.
Yeah.
And I happen to like Southwestern cuisine. Is there a lot of Southwestern cuisine in Lafayette? Lafayette doesn't seem like a Southwestern town to me.
No.
Yeah.
I was tempted to name it like Mexican vegetarian cornbread bake, but it's really just sort of a Southwestern flavor.
Mm-hmm.
There are very good Mexican restaurants around here, but No, not particularly.
I don't think of Lafayette as the Santa Fe of Indiana.
No, surely not.
Well, let's put this together.
Okay, we start out with 1 tablespoonful of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Notice how I said olive. It's like oil, and olive just comes out of my mouth. I just automatically think of it. Any oil that you use, canola, olive oil? What do you use? Anything?
I just used regular vegetable oil.
Good.
I think you could use anything.
Yeah. I think, and basically, I always tell people the oil of choice that you want to use for cooking is either canola oil, which is good under high heat, or olive oil, which adds flavor, but the hotter you make it, the more you actually ruin the oil. Peanut oil is also quite good, especially if you're going to be cooking it at higher levels. So, tablespoon of oil, 1/2 cup of diced onions.
Half a cup of diced onions.
And you dice them really fine?
Pretty fine diced.
Pretty fine diced. Okay, how about the green peppers? 1/2 cup of green peppers diced.
Probably a little bit larger for the green peppers.
So I kind of chop them. And that's what I would do. I'd dice the onions. I mean, they'd be wonderful. And then you'd chop the pepper. A box of Jiffy cornbread mix.
Yep, I chose Jiffy cornbread mix just because it's pretty inexpensive and easy. And I'm a poor graduate student, so the price was important to me. But I think you could use, if you have a homemade cornbread recipe or something like that that you prefer, I think you could use that just as easily.
Yeah, but you're a student and don't have a lot of time for that.
Or
yeah,
a lot
exactly.
of money. But yeah, actually, there was an article that I read a couple of years ago in the New York Times where they had people who are cornbread aficionados who were tasting various kinds of cornbread. And then they looked at how people actually make cornbread. And Jiffy cornbread mix actually came out on top of the heap.
Go away, did it really?
It actually came out as a delicious. Now, there are cornbread aficionados who will send me emails and say no. But Jiffy, when I read the article, I started going to Jiffy. It's great. And Jiffy is cheap. Now, we don't get any money from Jiffy. They don't support the show.
Right.
I just want to.
But we'd take it if they wanted.
We would. If there are any if the Jiffy CEO is listening today, please Zorba Pastor on your health. We love your products. Way.
All right. What else?
A can of black beans drained and rinsed.
Black beans drained and rinsed.
Yeah, important to rinse it because the muck, it's not really muck, but around the bean, if you don't mix it, it doesn't have that same texture to it. So I think the rinsing is important. A 1/2 can of corn drained. 3/4 cup of salsa. 1 teaspoon of cumin. Now use a cup of low-fat Mexican blend cheese divided. Tell us a little bit about that.
Personally, cheese is my favorite food, so it's not optional for me. But if you're wanting to cut calories or don't react well to dairy, I guess, I generally put a little bit of cheese in the center of the casserole and then a little bit on top. But if you want to forego that, I think it's just as tasty without it.
So you use a Mexican cheese that you buy in the grocery store?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So Mexican cheese, 1 egg, it's required, of course, for the cornbread mix, and 1/3 cup of milk also required for the cornbread mix, and then some garlic powder, salt, and pepper.
Yep.
So let's put it together. Preheat the oven at 350 degrees. Grease a 9x9 baking dish with cooking spray. Good way to cut down on the calories. Then in a large skillet or a frying pan, heat the oil over medium-low heat. Sauté the onions and green peppers for a few minutes until they're kind of tender and crisp. And meanwhile, prepare the cornbread mix according to the directions on the box. And set that batter aside. Then pour the black beans and corn into the onion and green pepper mix. Stir it around. Mix in the salsa very gently. Sprinkle the cumin and the other spices over the top. Stir it again, nice and gently. Once the mixture is warm and the desired flavor is achieved, pour the contents. In other words, it's nice and warm. Taste it. See if you like the taste. Then pour the contents of the pan into the prepared casserole dish, the one you sprayed. Spread it out. Sprinkle 1/2 cup of cheese over the top of the blend and then pour the cornbread mixture over the top. Sounds like a lasagna almost. Over the top, and then bake it uncovered for 20 minutes. Remove it, add the remaining half cup of cheese, and bake for an additional 10 minutes. Why do you do that? How'd you figure that out?
Well, if you put the cheese on at the beginning, it's going to get crunchy and dry and hard. But I generally just bake it for a little while, let the cornbread set, and then put the cheese on the top at the end just to let it melt for a little while. I also have a suggestion in terms of the cornbread batter. When you mix it up, it thickens up a bit. So I usually add a little bit more milk to it to loosen it up and make it pourable and spreadable.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of a warning that there is just enough cornbread mixture in a box to cover the top of the bean mixture. So I usually sort of make a big mound in the center of the casserole dish and really delicately spread it to all four corners. And it seems like it just fits, but it fills up nicely when you bake it, and it fills the whole dish. But just sort of a warning. It seems like there's not enough, but there is.
But there is. I like it. I love the inventiveness of this recipe. I'm going to try it. It just looks really neat, really interesting, and I consider myself a good cook, too. And when I have friends who come over, are vegetarian, I find it sort of like, oh, duh, what am I going to make? And I've noticed the same thing. I tend to have my recipes around the animal protein that I'm using.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And this is, honestly, I find it to be almost sort of like a comfort food because it's really warm and satisfying and filling. And I mean, my mom is a vegetarian also, and my dad, on the other hand, is a big sturdy logger and truck driver, and even he enjoys it and he finds it filling as well. So it doesn't seem like it's as low fat as it is. It's really tasty and satisfying.
Right. Erica, thank you so much.
All right, thank you so much, Tom.
For sending us this winning recipe. Erica gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Boyceville, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, back 4 years ago in 2006, I was taking regular birth control pills, and then I developed a pulmonary embolism. So I was told I could no longer take them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So after looking into my options, I decided on the Depo-Provera shot. I had my first one in July of 2006, and I had the second shot in September. And by that time, I noticed that I had been really putting on weight. And so when I went back in for my third shot a couple months later, they said, oh, yeah, you could gain a little weight from the Depo-Provera. And I said, well, okay, no more shots for me. That's it. Ultimately, in less than 6 months, I had put on 80 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, well, I'm not going to give up my weight now. But
sure.
I mean, I was petite, and now I'm not.
Well, let's go into kind of what different hormones will do. First of all, the hormones don't, in either estrogen or Depo-Provera, which is a progesterone, they don't actually put on weight, but they may change your appetite. In other words, even though you are not aware of a change in your eating habits, there has been a change in your eating habits. In other words,
okay,
the shot doesn't actually put on the weight. It doesn't.
Oh.
That's not the way it works. Not as if you get a shot and all of a sudden the weight comes on. You have to eat the calories. If you put on 80 pounds, you had to eat significantly more calories. You may not be aware of it,
okay,
because it may occur at each meal or it may occur between meals. So to you, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of a mystery. But the only way drugs put on weight is by encouraging. They may change metabolism a little bit, but
okay,
they tend to change. They tend to really change appetite. There are a couple of things you can do. First of all, start the Depo-Provera. See if the weight goes off. First thing.
I've been off of it for 4 years.
And if the weight didn't come off, it's not the Depo-Provera. I mean, the weight stayed on. You know, it may have encouraged appetite at that time, but then you've changed your appetite. The other thing to look at is thyroid. Make sure that you're not hypothyroid. It would be a lot of weight to gain for people who are hypo or low thyroid, but I'd get my thyroid checked in that. And if that's not the case, then what I would do is I would go to an organization. I happen to like Weight Watchers a lot, and I would change my dietary habits, and I would follow that and try to shed that weight. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not unusual for people to gain weight in a bunch, and then they keep that weight on. It's okay. Easier to put weight on than take it off because our body is feast or famine. In other words, put the calories on, save them, because there's going to be a famine, you know, a year down the line. And when we try to take off weight, our body becomes more efficient. But you need to get a handle on the weight, and the way to do it is to figure out what you're actually eating. And following a Weight Watchers type diet, I think, is good.
Okay.
Good luck to you. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, it's time.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me guess. We're going to go to our inbox, right?
That's right. A quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. We'll see if we can help out CT from Southern Illinois. You like CT? That's cool.
I like it, CT.
CT from Southern Illinois. CT has a question about milk. He writes, I sometimes drink espresso with the steam-heated milk. I know coffee has benefits, but are there any negative effects from heating the fats in the milk with steam? I always notice the milk forms accretions on the steamer stem on the coffee maker. Can this be happening to my arteries because the milk is heated? Are you laughing at CT?
Well, you know what I like? I like the word accretions. Yeah. I mean, how many people use accretions in a sentence? This is somebody who knows crossword puzzles. That's what I can guess from this, from my Sherlock Holmes brains. But the answer is accretions on the stem of the espresso maker do not produce accretions on your arteries at all. It's fine to heat up milk. It's really the protein that heats up on the surface along with the fat. If you heat milk in a pot, you know, it makes a little skim.
Yeah, it does.
On the top of a pot, we've all had warm milk. Our moms have done it, or we've actually made it ourselves. It's okay to heat up milk. Nothing bad happens. You're not destroying your arteries. Remember, we always tend to use low-fat dairy products because we know they're healthier. Enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. And the word is that espresso tastes pretty good.
The word is the espresso tastes pretty good, and the word of the day is accretion. Use it in a sentence and get $100.
Is a lifestyle question getting you steamed up? Let us help by sending us your questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. Some interesting research to talk over. More of your calls and our medical myth buster as well, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Here it is, Zorba, 3/4 of the way through the program, and I still have kind of a voice, so that I'm crossing my fingers for the rest of the way. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And before our next call, Zorba, we talk about salt.
That's right, salt. Well, salt is interesting, isn't it? Salt was used to preserve food for millions of years, and salt used to be expensive. And what happens is we like to salt our foods. And as time has gone on, just like our foods have become sweeter, our foods have become saltier.
Yeah, and now there's concern about too much salt.
Well, there's been concern for years.
But you in the past, I remember this, have poo-pooed those concerns.
Well, because about 20 to 25% of the people are salt sensitive. sensitive who have high blood pressure. A lot of people who have high blood pressure are not salt sensitive, but some people are salt sensitive. And the Institute of Medicine, which is a very, very renowned, they're sort of the gold standard, no doubt about it, when they come out with recommendations, has said we have too much salt in America. We're eating too much salt, and that's producing high blood pressure. And not everyone gets treated effectively for high blood pressure. So let's start to reduce salt in our diet. And the place to start is with prepared foods.
Yeah. You've mentioned this a number of times, that the salt we shake on top of the food is nowhere near as much as the salt that's already in the food.
100%. Absolutely. That's the issue. If you're going to salt your food, salt it with kosher salt. And the reason is it's a thicker sort of, it's not a molecule. It's the same molecule, but it's thicker and you can use less and get the same salty taste on the tip of your tongue, but when you cook with it, it's something else. Now, companies like the company that makes Chef Boyardee has said, we will start reducing salt. It's a voluntary issue, and they actually started about 2 years ago doing this.
And now there are a number of other companies, I think 16 or so, that are doing the same. This is really interesting. It's not the food industry fighting the government over this issue. They're saying, okay, we're going to go ahead and try to fix
this. Right, and they're going to do it because they're afraid they're going to be regulated. And so they're afraid that all of a sudden there's going to be a limit, or they're going to have to label it, this is a high salt item. And what happens is over the years, we've just produced more and more salt in this. And they discovered that if they go to a low salt, low sodium product, nobody likes it because often it's 20 to 25% less salt. But if they remove it by 3 to 5% per year, people don't seem to notice it.
Yeah, well, we don't know. They haven't gotten down to the bottom.
No.
Yet.
They've actually started, well, we don't know where the bottom is, but they've started reducing salt instead of the high salt products. So my recommendation is this. Prepared foods, if you're going to have them, they're part of America, read that label and read the salt label, just like you look at the fat label and the calorie label, and go for prepared foods that have less salt. Or better than that, start cooking yourself at home and do not cook with salt in your food, but just salt the surface.
Why did you point at me on that one? 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a listener now, Zorba, in Beechwood, New Jersey. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, I have been diagnosed with severe, they called it off-the-charts, severe carpal tunnel in both hands. They want me to have, you know, kind of immediate surgery. And I have been doing everything I can holistically and homeopathically, but I'm getting some results, and then I seem to take 4 or 5 steps backwards.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would guess, though, that you didn't need a diagnosis of severe carpal tunnel. You already knew you had it, right?
Well, you know, I'm a little dense sometimes, and I kind of thought I had a pinched nerve in my neck, and that's why my fingers were going numb, and then I started having a lot of pain at night, and actually someone said to me, you know, it sounds like those three fingers on both hands, that's usually carpal tunnel.
That's right. That's right. And that's not unusual, by the way. A lot of people think it's, you know, they don't know right away it's carpal tunnel, and you may think it's a pinched nerve. It is a pinched nerve. It just happens to be in the wrist and not in the neck. But let's talk about the treatments. First of all, there can be a non-surgical treatment of injection into the carpal tunnel with steroids. Sometimes that works for people. Often it doesn't, but sometimes it does work with people, and sometimes one or two injections might simply do the trick. So that's one issue. The other issue, in addition to that, is to try homeopathic issues. Acupuncture, acupressure, wrist splints that you wear at nighttime, massage therapy, doing exercises with physical therapy, changing the way you attend to the computer, putting a gel strip in front of the computer so that you're not actually putting pressure over the carpal bones. The carpal bones are the little bones in the wrist that allow you to move your wrist. Mm-hmm. They're all quite useful. And if you want to live with symptoms, you live with the symptoms. If you decide you want to have the surgery, then, you know, they basically cut the ligament and allows the nerve not to have pressure on it. And the nerve doesn't really breathe, but we kind of say that, but that's not really what it does. But I don't have, other than if you, you know, you can try steroids injected into the carpal tunnel, that would work, but you've tried everything else and you know, it's a Hobson's choice. It's a rock and a hard place.
The surgery is pretty successful, isn't it?
Yeah, I've had carpal tunnel surgery. Mm-hmm. Am I right? My symptoms went away. I mean, I think the surgery is awesome and it works, but it's surgery. It's surgery.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, anytime I have to have surgery, I have to try everything else first.
Well, but, no, I think
we're at that point.
I think trying everything else first makes a difference. Now, when you look at surgery, there are different people who do carpal tunnel surgery. You want somebody who does a lot of them. You want somebody who is not going to put you in a splint for a couple of weeks. You want somebody who gives a small incision, a tiny incision. I would have carpal tunnel surgery done by a hand surgeon or a neurosurgeon. Now, there are many orthopedic surgeons that also do carpal tunnel. I would say, how big is the incision? And am I put in a splint? There's some orthopedic surgeons who then put people in a plaster splint for 2 to 3 weeks. That's not the one I would recommend. I would recommend a soft splint for a few days and a minimal incision. You want somebody who's used to working in a very tiny space. They do a better surgery and the recovery is quicker.
Terrific. Thank you so much. I just love your show.
Oh, aren't you nice?
I so appreciate the help. And you know, I always learn something every week. So.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from Beatrice in New York City about the health benefits of saunas. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, can you settle a discussion on the medical benefits, if any, on one of those infrared saunas? Salesmen claim they can relieve a multitude of body pains."
Well, first of all, they may relieve a multitude of body pains. I happen to have a hot tub at home, and when I ache, I get in the hot tub. I feel great. I've got a really good friend in Quebec, and he loves his sauna, goes into a sauna. He's a doc, does a lot of exercise. He goes into the sauna every night. Definitely you try it. It often does relieve pains. And I don't – I mean, I'm talking about a traditional sauna. I don't know what the infrared sauna is, but I have a I had a grandfather. My grandfather had a World War I injury, and he had two red lights that he would – every day he would come home, lived with us for about 5 years. He'd put them on his shoulder, and it would help relieve the pain. I could tell that as a small child because he'd stop swearing. So I knew it actually worked. So does it relieve pain? Absolutely, it works for a lot of people. Does it relieve cold symptoms? Well, some people wonder whether or not it's better for colds. The science on that is pretty minimal. So what I would recommend before you buy a sauna and have one in your house is try it out. Go somewhere where they have it. Go somewhere when you have an achy time and see whether or not it relieves your pain, because they are not cheap.
Yeah. Well, as you say, you don't know anything about these infrared.
No, but saunas. I can imagine it. They're like the infrared lights that my grandpa used. And for some people, they work well. You can get a gooseneck lamp. You can buy an infrared light on a gooseneck lamp. They still sell them at our local hardware store, Dorn Hardware, Oregon, Wisconsin. You can buy a gooseneck light and an infrared lamp and see if it works on your achy arms or achy wrists. See if that makes a difference.
If a myth is heating you up and you'd like Zorba to bust it, just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener with us in Pocatello, Idaho. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I was diagnosed with diabetes in October, and I'm having problems getting my sugars down. My sugars have been running 400 to 500 consistently. And when I first started taking the insulin, I noticed it would drop my sugars fairly quickly, but now it's not working. Is there something that I can do to stimulate my pancreas to produce more insulin?
Well, first of all, so you've got adult onset diabetes, type 2, I assume. Did they put you on any other drugs, metformin being one of the drugs that you used, or Januvia, anything else?
No, they put me on a fast-acting insulin and then a slow-acting insulin.
Okay.
The doctor indicated that it was from a car accident about 6 years ago and that my body's attacked my pancreas.
Oh, but sometimes you can have trauma to the pancreas where it stops producing insulin. I've heard of that. I don't know how scientifically based it is, but I know that has occurred in some. What kind of doctor are you going to?
Family doctor.
See, the first question I would have is whether or not you should be on some oral medications in addition. There's a drug called metformin, M-E-T-F-O-R-M-E-M-I-N, I think. I can never spell things as well. But that's a drug that's commonly also used on patients who have type 2 diabetes. That's often used along with insulin. So that would be one question I would have, whether or not that drug would work for you. Another drug called Januvia, J-U-N-I-V-I-A, I believe is how it's spelled, can also work and help make the insulin work better. And then, of course, there are different types of long-acting insulin, Lantus being one of the long-acting insulin.
I'm on that.
And you're on Lantus. Are you taking it once a day or twice a day?
Once a day.
And how many units are you taking?
18.
So 18 once a day. So one of the things we do is we just push up the Lantus. So you just push up the Lantus to the point where it works. And you have to talk to your family doc. And sometimes I'll send people to a diabetic nurse practitioner. In my practice, they do an excellent job. And all they do is diabetes. And they sit down, they look at your numbers, and they correspond it. You need more intensive care with what you have. Your numbers should be below 200. Your numbers should be about 120.
Is there anything that I can do to stimulate my pancreas?
Well, we know
it worked for 40 years.
Yeah, well, things do work for 40 years. Why do people get heart disease after 50 or 60 years? The things that work for diabetes are exercise. Exercise pushes blood sugar into your, into your muscle. But we don't have anything of a non-drug way to stimulate your pancreas to produce more insulin. There's nothing invented. Glyburide, which is a drug that's used early on with diabetes, not with a blood sugar you're high, can push the pancreas a little bit, but it's really not that effective.
Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Now, Zorba, let's grab one last question from Zorba Pastor on your health's inbox before we leave for the week. This question comes to us from Corey in St. Louis, Missouri. Corey writes, I am a smoker. I know, bad boy. I also lift weights 4 days a week, and I'm wondering what effect, if any, my smoking is having on my muscle growth during recovery. I'm seeing gains in muscle, but I feel like I'm not getting the full effect.
Well, you may not be getting the full effect for a bunch of reasons. It may be your training technique. It may be, whether or not you're lifting the right weights in the right way. That's one aspect, obviously, that's there. People who smoke cigarettes clearly can still gain muscle because I go to the gym, and I go to the gym at the university, and sometimes I'll see people leave the gym and smoke, and I'll think, my gosh, how can they do it? But people do that. You increase your circulation when you quit smoking. Circulation, basically smoking cigarettes increases carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, rather, in your bloodstream. And that probably has a negative training effect. In other words, so although you're training with weights, you're losing some from smoking. So yeah, better training, cut the cigarettes. Both of those are probably going to improve your physique.
Well, let us do the heavy lifting with your lifestyle problem. Just send your questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by WPR's version of Bialystok and Bloom, Adam Friedrich, and Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0508Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.